Greetings and welcome to the latest edition of the Entheogenic Evolution Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Martin, and I'm happy to have you with me today. For this week's episode, I'm going to be continuing on with the quote-unquote discussion around symposia, but it's going to be more of a monologue because, as I stated last week, I have invited members of symposia, including Russell Hausfeld, the creator of the article and video that has created such a hullabaloo out there in the world, to come and be in my podcast, and they have all declined. I would not say that they have politely declined, because they have not been polite in any way, shape, or form. So, I'm going to continue with my own response to all of them. And this week's episode is entitled, Symposia, The Treachery of Images. And while it is directed towards symposia in general, in specific and in particular, this episode is directed to Russell Hausfeld. He is the man of the hour here on the Entheogenic Evolution Podcast. As you all know, from last week, I submitted a number of questions to Russell, which he has declined to comment on or respond to. And I also proposed a number of questions to symposia themselves, everybody included. No one has given me any kind of response whatsoever. They are not interested in dialogue. They are not interested in conversation. They and Russell are interested in the treachery of images. Ooh, spooky, yeah? You like that? I like that title. It's not mine. So we're going to start there. We're going to start there, Russell. We're going to start with the idea of the treachery of images. Last week, I recommended that you go back to school and get some more schooling. And, well, that's what we're going to do a little bit of here right now. Okay? Let's do that. This is going to be fun. I think you'll enjoy it. I know I will. So, what is the treachery of images? This is something that you, Russell, I don't know, maybe you're familiar with this or not. You out there in listener land, all the rest of you listening to this, maybe you're familiar with this, but maybe you've seen this. There's a painting of a pipe, and underneath the painting of the pipe, it reads, "Ceci n'est pas une pipe," which of course is French, which means, "This is not a pipe." This is a painting by René Magritte, painted in the year 1929, part of the Surrealism artistic movement. And the pipe itself is not painted in any kind of surreal sense. What René is doing here, and this is the title of the painting, it's often called "This is Not a Pipe," but the actual title of the painting is "The Treachery of Images," or in French, La Trahison des Images, the treachery of images, or even the treason of images. Because here we very clearly have a painting of a pipe. So we have a representation, we have an image of a pipe. Yet right underneath it, it says, "This is not a pipe." And what René Magritte is doing here, of course, is creating a narrative or a meta narrative around representationalism in art and also representationalism in general. Because it raises the philosophical question, is the thing that is presented in imagistic form, what is it? Is it the thing itself? Which he is stating clearly, it is not. It looks like a pipe, but in reality, it is pigment applied to canvas, and therefore, it's not a pipe. But when we look at it, we can say, well, that's a pipe, right? I can see it. I can see it right there. Clearly, that's a pipe, but it's not actually a pipe. So, Russell, you see where I'm going with this? Are you getting it? I think maybe you are. Because Here, we all live in the internet age, where everything is represented online. And it can raise the philosophical question for us, is the thing represented that we see or hear online, is that actually the thing in and of itself? Is the framing and representation the same as that which is being represented and framed? And how does reframing something affect our interpretation of that which has been reframed? This is raising rather deep philosophical questions. And in some respects, it actually dates all the way back to Plato in classical Greek philosophy, where Plato proposed that there are these forms, these ideal forms, and these ideal forms emanate from the One, which is God, and through various permutations of the light of God projecting out from itself, the One, that these idealized forms are then the pure representation or embodiment of beauty, truth, etc. And that then this becomes embodied in 3D reality. And so, for example, by reputation, Socrates was apparently not an attractive person, physically speaking. Yet in the Platonic dialogues, Plato represents Socrates as being the most beautiful person, because Socrates, in Plato's eyes, was an embodiment of truth and beauty, so that he more accurately reflected the form in his own image. This has also been reframed with the phrase, the map is not the territory, which again, we can look at a map, right? We can look at a map of the world and we can say, oh, look, there's Oregon, there's California. Oh, look, there's South America, there's Europe. But of course, the map is not the thing in and of itself. It's a representation of it. And it gives us a sense of orientation. It gives us a sense of perspective. But we all know that looking at a map of something is very different than experiencing the thing in and of itself. So you can look at a place on a map that you've never been to, and you can even go to Google Earth and you can zoom in and you can drive around neighborhoods. And that's a virtual representation, but it's still not the experience of actually being there. And this is why people like to travel, for example, that you look at a place and you say, wow, that looks like a nice place to go. I want to experience that in some capacity. But merely looking at a map, or merely looking at images, or merely looking at videos, it's not going to do it for you, right? So again, this idea, the treachery of images, that the production of images and the framing of images represents a perspective, represents an interpretation, represents a view, but is not the thing that is being represented in and of itself. So here this applies to our situation, because what Russell has done with his video is that he has represented me in a very particular way and reframed me in a very particular way. And yeah, you've probably all seen this on Facebook, that Russell and others for Symposia, they keep coming back to you, but you said this, you said this, you said this, you said this. And that has never been the controversy. Yeah, I said all those things. I did all those things. But the deeper question then is why? Now, Symposia has wanted to frame me as some kind of predator, an abuser, in a very simple terms, as a real bad guy. Yet they've never asked the deeper questions. you know, last week I mentioned that Russell Hausfeld says that he has a bachelor's degree in investigative journalism. Yet his journalism is incredibly superficial. So there's no real investigation going on there. Again, it's reaching for low-hanging fruit. Now, Russell, I see from your bio on Symposia that not only do you have a bachelor's degree in quote-unquote investigative journalism, but also in religious studies. You know, it's almost too bad that you didn't go to Southern Oregon University, because then you might have had the opportunity to take a religious studies course with me. And who knows what you might have learned? Possibly, we could have even been friends. Who knows? I don't know you. You haven't given me the opportunity to know you. And, you know, I'll just be upfront and honest here. I have not done you the favor of digging through your material with Symposia. I haven't really looked at any of the information put out by Symposia. I'm sure you're aware of the reputation that Symposia has. It's not very positive from what I've heard. But anyway, so let's talk about religious studies for just a moment. Let's go to Buddhism, because I think that this also serves as a really good example. So in early Buddhist iconography, keeping in mind that Buddhism was a countercultural movement in India, roughly 2,500 years ago, where Buddha was a revolutionary. The standard text, the authoritative text of the time, were the Vedas. And virtually all branches of Hinduism, of which there are many, relate in one way or another to the Vedas. And the Vedas, you know, as we all know, hopefully, the first Veda, the Rig Veda, is all about the consumption of mind-altering substances in order to have a non-dual and mystical experience. And the other Vedas, they deal with prayers and with rituals and eventually get into the construction of the caste-based system of dharma and karma within the Indian worldview, and has all kinds of different gods and goddesses and all the different ways to perform rituals and appease these gods and earn their favor and gain their assistance on the path to enlightenment. And Buddha was a revolutionary where he came in and said, you know what? The Vedas are irrelevant. They don't matter. They don't actually have anything to do with the nature of enlightenment or the process of enlightenment. So you can ignore that. Oh, and all that stuff about dharma and karma that puts you into a different caste, that's totally irrelevant as well. So he was a revolutionary. And he also said, you know, don't believe me. Try out the things that I'm sharing with you. Just try it for yourself. And then see what you think. So in early Buddhism, which was later renamed Hinayana Buddhism by the Mahayana Buddhists, who came about some 500 years after the time of the original Buddha. But in early Buddhism, Hinayana Buddhism, which means small vehicle Buddhism, Buddha is not treated as a divine figure in any sense. He is treated as a teacher and as a pathfinder. And he is known as the one who has thus gone. So in early Buddhist iconography, there are no images of the Buddha. Early Buddhists did not in any way worship the Buddha. He was not treated as a savior. He was not treated as some deity. He was a teacher. Again, he was a pathfinder. And so in early Buddhist iconography, what we find actually are just footprints, and the footprints represent the Buddha. And it goes back to this idea of the treachery of images. in the sense that early Buddhists wanted to show that, look, the Buddha is just the person who has laid out the path to this experience of nirvana and this state of being, this escape from the wheel of samsara, of birth, life, death, and then rebirth. But the Buddha himself is not the point of the religion of Buddhism. It's the teachings that he shared. That's what's important. And so we just have some footprints here to show that the Buddha was here, but now the Buddha is gone. Later, in Mahayana Buddhism, that's when we start actually getting images of the Buddha sitting in meditation, lying down when he reached parinirvana, images of the Buddha when he tried starving himself, when he was practicing austerities, and you know, you can see his ribs and all of that. And this is also a period when a great deal of Buddhist art was made. So, you know, we have these statues and we have these different images. And what became a common theme within Buddhist art is the idea of the finger pointing to the moon. So in a lot of Buddhist art, in one top corner of the piece of art, there is an image of the Buddha, and he's pointing. And the question is, well, what is he pointing at? Then on the other side of the image, there is the moon. And the moon is representational of the state of nirvana and of enlightenment. And the moon is significant because the moon does not produce its own light. It reflects light. So here, nirvana is being characterized as the clear light of the mind, where you can reflect reality back in a way that is clear and undistorted. Now, the important thing is not the Buddha. The important thing is, what is the Buddha pointing at? Now, in a metaphorical sense, Russell, what you've done is you've focused in on the finger, and you're like, what about the finger? What about the finger? Look at this finger. What about the finger? Well, Russell, what is the finger pointing towards? That's the deeper question. That's the more interesting question in my mind. What is that? What is he pointing at? Why is he pointing at it? Or do we just want to obsess over the finger? I think you clearly are obsessing over the finger. You know, I've seen some of the things that you've done on Facebook. Like, you've gone and you've copied and pasted 1-star reviews of my books on Amazon. Ooh, ow, Russell, that really hurts. You know, you could just as easily copy and paste 5-star reviews of my books from Amazon. You know, I don't know if there's any like 2- or 3-star reviews. I don't know. I already acknowledged last week that people tend to be fairly polarized in how they react to my work. That they're either like, there's something interesting here. This dude's pointing at something kind of interesting and I'd like to know more. Or they react in whatever manner they've been triggered. And, you know, I'm okay with that. And I don't care if you copy and paste 1-star reviews of my books. I don't care, Russell. I know they're there. I know how people react to me. I've been me a lot longer than you've been you, man. Oh. So the treachery of images. There's a couple ways I want to take this little conversation with Russell now. Well, yeah, there's another thing that Russell has been reposting along with other members of Symposia. And I suppose this goes for all you guys. You found that nice little audio clip of me from Exploring Psychedelics in 2018. Yeah, you know the one I'm talking about. Any guesses as to who released that audio clip onto the internet? Do you just want to guess? Who do you think it was? Who do you think values transparency and openness and honesty? I wonder who that could be. Who put that audio clip on the internet, Russell? Have you done your research? Do you know? If you didn't know before right now, I think you probably know. And what was that little audio clip about? Well, I was speaking in that moment to people who use images and impressions created on the internet who do not have the courage to engage in actual conversation and inquiry with the person they are targeting and hide behind the safety of never actually having a conversation, of never actually attempting to get to know someone, and uses the internet to spread hate and negative imagery and images of others. Now, Russell, does that remind you of anyone at all? I think it probably does. So, in a sense, I said that for you. Whoa. I'm going to have a sip of water after that one. Okay. Let's get to Mark Hayden for a moment. I know that Mark Hayden has been a focus of the attacks that you guys like to perpetuate over there at Symposia, indulging in the treachery of images. Russell, have you ever had a conversation with Mark Hayden? Do you know him at all? I'm curious. Have you listened to the interview that I have with Mark Hayden here on my podcast? It's up. It's available. You can listen to it. Mark Hayden, the former executive director of Maps Canada, I think is one of the nicest, sweetest men I've ever met. He is sincerely a great guy. He's a wonderful guy. He has dedicated his life to making psychedelic medicines and therapies available to the world. And you people over at Symposia, and you, Russell, have trashed him. And you've used me as low-hanging fruit to frame your treachery of images to bring suffering into his life. Where the fuck are your journalistic ethics, Russell? Honestly, this is an honest question to you. Where are they? What principles are guiding the work that you are doing? is this really what you want your work to be? Is this really what you want your legacy to be? Framing people? Maligning their character without getting to know them? Really, Russell? Really? Honestly? Because we all know this whole thing that we are engaged in right now was triggered by the fact that I was the editor and publisher of Mark Haden's book. That's where you guys decided, oh, let's write an article about Mark Haden and then fill it with all kinds of reframed stuff about Martin Ball. And let's make it really bad. Let's get people really outraged. And I know you guys say, no, the outrage is because of the things you said. Yeah, from a video that's been around for 5 fucking years, Russell. It's been out there for 5 years and has never generated the outrage and the backlash until you decided to reframe it through the treachery of images. That's on you, Russell. So now Maps Canada has hired a PR person and they are requiring Mark to remove any mention of me from the book. So, you know, let's review the really shocking information that I contributed to this book, shall we? Let's see. Where's the issue, Russell? Can you point it out to me, Russell? Please? All right. This has now been removed from the book. This is no longer available. Manual for Psychedelic Guides. Forward. Psychedelics are not for everyone, and not everyone who wants to serve psychedelics to others is necessarily qualified or skilled enough to do so without causing harm. The ecology of the modern psychedelic movement is diverse. There are therapeutic approaches, shamanic approaches, religious and spiritual approaches, psychoanalytic approaches, and recreational and personal approaches. Some individuals undergo years of training, either with a traditional shaman or provider, or perhaps as part of a therapy training program at a graduate institute. Still others, inspired by their own positive and intriguing experiences with psychedelics, develop an evangelical stance desiring to share the magic with as many people as possible, and perhaps with no training whatsoever. The reality is that interest in and access to psychedelics in both legitimate clinics and retreat centers and among underground practitioners and providers is growing exponentially around the planet. The psychedelic renaissance is well underway, and it is transforming how we look at health, spirituality, religion, well-being, personal growth and development, and even how we think of the nature of consciousness and the nature of reality itself. In many areas of the world, there is already legal access to psychedelic medicines in a variety of environments and experiential methodologies. In other areas of the world, legal access to psychedelic medicines is fast approaching and will soon be a prominent feature of healthcare systems and increasingly in spiritual and religious communities. Traditional cultures that have used psychedelics for healing, spirituality, religion, and personal transformation have thousands of years of experience and tradition to draw upon in their use of these extraordinarily powerful tools of consciousness. However, in much of the non-traditional modern world, use of psychedelics and practices and concerns around serving and facilitating them in experiential modalities is something of a Wild West, where there is little conformity, oversight, or professional associations with clear guidelines and systems of ethics and best practices. While this is due to some extent to the often illegality of psychedelics in many countries that have been saturated in misleading and unscientific propaganda around the supposed dangers of psychedelics, it is also due to the fact that many people simply feel called to share the medicine and have no training, supervision, or mentorship. As legal access to psychedelic medicines grow, we can expect that diverse methodologies and practices will still be present, but there will also be greater awareness around what exactly are not only safe and effective treatment modalities, but what also makes someone a skilled guide. What personal traits, psychological types, interpersonal behaviors, and interpretive modes are best suited to the profession? It is to that end that Mark Hayden, Executive Director of MAPS Canada, has produced this timely and highly relevant manual for psychedelic guides. This book of well-sourced advice and guidelines is a must-read for anyone who either wants to serve psychedelics or those who already do so. Consensus is building in the psychedelic movement around best practices and harm reduction. As with any other expression of human behavior and culture, there have been abusive behaviors in psychedelic circles. Unqualified individuals have offered powerful psychedelics to those who have not been properly screened or prepared. Power-hungry individuals and on occasion, those with abusive psychological tendencies have been drawn to the work. This is not a reflection of psychedelics in and of themselves. It is a reflection of the dynamics of human interaction and relation. The reality is that many get into the business of providing psychedelics to others with no training or little awareness of professional ethics and behavioral protocols, such as with preparation, navigation, and the all-important integration. In any endeavor in which there is an inherent power imbalance, which is certainly the case between psychedelic guides and participants, there is a need for guidance, supervision, and at least minimal community oversight. Anything as powerful and effective as psychedelics, and here there is no doubt whatsoever, needs proper guidelines, suggestions, and effective modalities in order to maximize their healing and transformative potential, and lessen the potential dangers and pitfalls that come with the use of any kind of powerful tool. This manual for psychedelic guides comes at the perfect time. Here in Oregon, where I'm writing this, the initiative to legalize psilocybin-assisted therapy just qualified for the ballot to be voted on this coming November. Similar measures will soon be appearing across the United States, let alone across the world. Religious and spiritual use of ayahuasca and peyote have already been legalized within the state of Oregon. Many communities across the U.S. are also experiencing a wave of decriminalization movements where local governments are encouraged not to criminalize and prosecute the use of psychedelics and plant medicines. The sea change is already here. The time for clear guidance is not some indefinite time in the future, either near or far. It is right now. Psychedelic therapy, religion, and spirituality is here, now, and it only shows signs of increasing. As the world moves beyond the limited and misinformed War on Drugs program, as initiated by the United States and reinforced by the United Nations and member states, the general public is increasingly being informed as to the efficacy and safety of psychedelic use and therapy. Anyone who has been paying attention has seen articles about psychedelics in a variety of publications, both print and online. Psychedelics are being featured with greater regularity in entertainment, movies, and television. Main characters undergo cathartic psychedelic experiences, such as was recently featured on Billions. Celebrities like Gwyneth Paltrow feature psychedelic healing in their branded infotainment programs. People like Mike Tyson proclaimed the transformative potential of toad medicine, 5-MeO-DMT. Even the puppeted Gelflings in the Dark Crystal are aware that there are certain berries that only the shamans eat to enter the spirit world. The proverbial cat is out of the bag, and there will be no going back. In order to move things forward in a positive, life-affirming, and professional way, this guide is offered to all who are interested in providing psychedelic medicines with wisdom, humility, and professional ethics and standards. May it be well-received and spark the necessary conversations that are needed around the globe as we collectively embrace the new psychedelic reality. Journey well. I don't know what's so dangerous about that. But now it's gone. It's been removed. It's no longer in the book. My name is no longer featured on the cover. It's no longer featured in the interior anywhere. And that's that. So let's talk about another thing you got canceled through your treachery of images, Russell. So, way back. I know you haven't done your research, Russell, so I'm going to help you out here a little bit. You know, I think in that article that you wrote about Mark Hayden, where you included all this salacious information about me, I think you mentioned that the Lamps video coincided with the release of my fifth book. Dude, you're not even close. My fifth book was Mushroom Wisdom, published in 2006. The video from Lamps, that was recorded in 2016. Yeah. Again, your investigative journalism leaves something to be desired. So let's talk about something else that got canceled here. After my very first 5-MeO-DMT experience, I sat down and wrote a short document that is called The Universal Declaration of the Human Right to Direct Spiritual Experience. And I'm going to share this with you now for a couple of reasons. One is because this is something that has now been canceled in at least one venue, thanks to Russell and Symposia. And because I'm going to compare it with something that I wrote later. So, I wrote this in 2008. And actually, a colleague of mine printed out all kinds of copies of this and has passed it out at various... Actually, several colleagues of mine have printed out copies and passed it around in various places, all the way from Burning Man to one colleague took it directly to the United Nations and passed it out there. Most recently, a colleague of mine was participating in an online psychedelic conference where all the presenters were asked to provide something that would be included in a PDF packet that would be given to everybody who registered for the event. And this colleague submitted this document for himself. He asked me permission first, of course, because that's what polite people do. And after the symposia video that you made, Russell, through your treachery of images, this was removed from the PDF packet that was given to everyone. Also, this colleague had apparently mentioned me several times in his pre-recorded talk, and he was informed that all references to me had been edited out. Thanks to you, Russell. These are some of the outcomes of your, quote, work. So I'm going to read this to you, and I'm going to ask you. You can come on the podcast. You can talk to me about it. Does this sound like something you are in support of? Do you think that maybe having more exposure to this document might serve the greater good in some capacity, or is trying to edit it out of existence, is that serving the greater good? So I wrote this in 2008, like I said, after my first 5-MeO-DMT experience. Russell, I see from your Facebook page that you were born in 1995, so you were 13 when I wrote this. Here it is, the Universal Declaration of the Human Right to Direct Spiritual Experience. We recognize the following. Human beings are innately spiritual. The human quest for spiritual meaning and experience is fundamental to the human experience. Personal spiritual experience is furthermore understood to be one of the most intimate aspects of a person's identity, sense of self, and worldview. While the human quest for spiritual meaning and experience can be institutionalized through the formation and continuation of religious traditions, the drive for spiritual meaning and experience is not limited to religious activity or membership per se. Religious practice and membership is not identical to spiritual experience. Religion, as a social institution, provides opportunity for like-minded people to gather together in groups to collectively express their beliefs in the context of shared practices. Religion provides structures of ritual, ceremony, religious teachings, and a community of similarly oriented individuals. Within the context of a religion, persons may be afforded the opportunity for direct spiritual experience, but this is not necessarily the case. As direct spiritual experience is primarily an individual matter, the locus of spiritual experience is necessarily the individual and not a religious tradition or institution. While religious membership and activity is universally recognized as a fundamental human right and is protected by law, individual pursuit of spiritual experience has not been afforded the same legal protections. This act seeks to correct this omission from the list of universal human rights. Because the locus of direct spiritual experience is the individual, protections for individual spiritual experience must be afforded directly to individuals rather than to the institutions in which they practice. As a result, protection for direct spiritual experience is not limited to individuals who are members of religious traditions, but extend equally to all individuals, regardless of religious affiliation or lack thereof. All practices that contribute to an individual's cultivation of direct spiritual experience are hereby affirmed to be protected by international laws recognizing universal human rights, with the condition that such practices do not violate any other universally recognized human rights of other persons, such as the rights to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. In recognition of this universal human right to direct spiritual experience, it is hereby decreed that no government shall persecute or punish any individual who chooses to pursue the cultivation of direct spiritual experience in a manner that is respectful of the human rights of others. It is furthermore recognized that the universal human right to direct spiritual experience provides a legal defense for those who would choose to pursue the use of entheogenic agents in their quest to achieve direct spiritual experience. While recognizing that governments have a vested interest in reducing the impact of recreational drug use and abuse within their territories, drug laws in and of themselves are not sufficient grounds for barring the legitimate use of entheogenic sacraments for personal spiritual experience. The burden of proof for the limiting of any activity that can be construed as the cultivation of direct personal spiritual experience is clearly placed on any regulating body, governmental or otherwise. The universal right to direct spiritual experience will be afforded to all equally without any interference by regulating bodies unless said regulating bodies can demonstrate beyond any doubt that the activities of any individual is in violation of the fundamental human rights of another person or persons. Claiming that an individual's practice, such as might be the case with the use of entheogens, is against any law is not sufficient grounds for disallowing the practice. The standard for the burden of proof is to be judged solely on how any given practice violates the rights of others. So, that was written during my, obviously, spiritual phase. I no longer consider myself to be spiritual because I like to emphasize just living in reality. That's my main deal, Russell. So my perspective has changed a bit. I still think that the Universal Declaration is good because you can see within that that I want all people's rights to psychedelic experience to be protected, whether it's therapeutic, whether it's religious, whether it's spiritual, whatever. And this seemed like an avenue of helping to secure that for people. And I was feeling very inspired. I had just experienced God. And not only had I experienced God, I'd experienced myself as God and God as everyone and everything. I asked in my previous podcast, for all of you there at Symposia, if you've had any experience with 5-MeO-DMT. So Russell, I'm just going to ask it directly to you. Do you have experience with 5-MeO-DMT? Have you experienced a non-dual state? Have you experienced a unitary state? You know, I'm genuinely curious, Russell. I mean, do you have any point of reference for what I've spent over the last decade talking about and sharing? Or do you just have a video and some audio clips and some bad reviews on Amazon? I mean, is that research for you, Russell? Is that the extent of your research? You know, I don't know. You won't come on here to talk to me, so I don't know. So we're going to now just talk about my book, Entheogenic Liberation, Unraveling the Enigma of Non-Duality with 5-MeO-DMT Energetic Therapy. This was released in 2017, so it's been out there for a while. And I'll just start, you know, right at the beginning with acknowledgments. Thanks to all who have sat with me over the years and provided me with the opportunity to learn the details of what I needed to know in order to write this book. This book is dedicated to all those who want to live in reality and who are willing to undergo the challenges of finding it for themselves. And a disclaimer. This work is for educational purposes. Readers are fully responsible for their own choices and actions. Now, I know, Russell, you want to present me through your treachery of images as some kind of serial abuser and power-hungry, I don't know. And you're really misrepresenting that I served 5-MeO-DMT to people, not as a provider, not to, here's the experience, enjoy it, and then we'll talk about it. But I went into each experience with each client that I had, every client that I ever worked with. And it was exploratory. It was a learning experience. And one of the primary reasons that I retired from doing this is because I had stopped seeing anything new show up in my sessions with people. And it was taking a toll on me physically. You know, all that purging that you really love to highlight, Russell, is taking a toll on me. And I felt that I'd really learned all that I was going to learn. And I wanted to share everything that I had learned, including some of the experiences that I'd had, such as in the lamps video. And I wanted to be sure that I was no longer doing that practice so that I could share it more openly. And the result was this book, Entheogenic Liberation. Now, when Russell first originally contacted me with his highly loaded questions via email, I wrote him back and I supplied him with a chapter here in the book, which is Being a Non-Dual Energetic Practitioner. That comes on page 165 of the book. I get the impression, Russell, that you have not actually read the book. So I'm going to share with you, here are the contents of the book. Here's all the stuff that I talk about before I even get to the section of being a non-dual energetic practitioner. It starts with an introduction. Then chapter 2 is The Prison, which talks about the nature of the ego. Next chapter is Approaches to Engaging Psychedelics. And here I cover a variety of different things. Recreational use, exploratory or psychonautical use, creative use, problem solving and novelty, therapeutic use, religious and spiritual use, sex and sexuality, and then a conclusion. Next chapter, non-duality, the ego, non-dual experience as a human birthright, psychedelics, entheogens, and non-duality, the radically awesome nature of God. I like that section. Next chapter, working with 5-MeO-DMT, considerations for a safe and secure setting, finding a good facilitator, being a witness, taking 5, the experiential arc, visuals, spontaneous reactivations, deeper medicine experiences, failure to reassemble, breath, vocalizing, purging, maybe we'll cover that one another time, spontaneous fluid symmetrical movements, mudras and hand gestures, positions, vibrating, afterglow, ongoing emotional releases, swinging the other way, post-session, whiteouts. Next chapter, challenging reactions, attachment to the experience, self-aggrandizement, no, the God, the universe, the medicine isn't calling you, attachment to providers, traumatic experience, Humpty Dumpty syndrome, mental health issues, displacement, projection, and attachment. The next chapter, the human energetic system, head, mouth and throat, heart and lungs, abdomen and digestive tract, genitals, energetic structures of the ego, symmetry versus asymmetry. Next chapter, thinking clearly, liberation through unknowing, beyond the body, loving yourself, all of yourself, personal preference versus universal love, letting go of the need for control, religion and spirituality, natural versus synthetic. Those are all the subjects that I write about before getting to the chapter, being a non-dual energetic practitioner. Now I'm going to share maybe all of that, or at least parts of that chapter with you, the audience here. But first, I do want to get to... Well, first I'm just going to read a little section from the introduction. It is my hope that you'll find this book to be the definitive work, not only on the 5-MeO-DMT experience, but also on the process of non-dual awakening and transformation, which is here presented as a form of therapy as opposed to spiritual practice or discipline. Everything presented here is fundamentally true to the best of my ability to articulate and express it. There are no speculations, metaphysics, or belief systems involved. As such, this is a book about reality and about you. It is a guide to help you find, encounter, and be yourself, free from illusion and confusion. Furthermore, everything presented here comes directly out of my own personal experience and practice. I've personally lived through everything communicated in these pages. As a result, you will not find references to anyone else's views, models, theories, or work. It is my presentation of what I've learned and experienced directly in myself and in the context of working with others. So, you know, that's how I was able to write this book. That's why I thanked everybody that I worked with, because that provided me with the information to write this book. And I know some people have taken issue with the word therapy. And so my question back is, well, then I don't know what to call it. That what I've identified as the quote-unquote disorder are the lies, illusions, and projections of the ego. And what I'm presenting in this book is a very specific methodology for uncovering those aspects of the ego, clearing out the energetic repression that is caused by these energetic patternings of the ego, and how to find them, release them, and then ultimately transform yourself as an individual. And I have not wanted to characterize it as a spiritual practice. I do not want to characterize it as shamanism. I do not want to characterize it as a medical procedure. So I've called it a form of therapy. And by using the word therapy, I'm also pointing towards the idea that it's not about singular experiences. It's about ongoing work to uncover your unconscious patterns and where you have repressed and suppressed yourself, and release that and transform that. So it's very similar, ultimately, to the goals that you might have in seeking traditional forms of psychotherapy or mental health. So that's why I've used therapy. Now, if people want to take issue with that, that's fine. We can have a conversation about, well, what do we mean by therapy? I'm using this word here because I'm not wanting to use spiritual terminology. And I'm also not wanting to use necessarily psychological or medical terminology. And I'm definitely not looking to use religious terminology. So that's what I chose. If you have another suggestion, well, go ahead, make it. So before we get to being a non-dual energetic practitioner, I just thought I'd share this section of non-dual experience as a human birthright, because this shows a bit of the transformation from that 2008 document, the Universal Declaration of the Human Right to Direct Spiritual Experience, because here again, I'm trying to move away from spiritual language, spiritual identity. Okay? I'm trying to get to something more universal and more basic than that. Though rights are a conventional concept and not absolute, for the sake of communicative ease, knowing the true nature of the self can be described as a human birthright. Rights are a construct of modern social and political discourse. They don't exist out there in reality in any fundamental sense. They are the product of social agreement that acknowledges that there are some issues so fundamental to the human experience that they should be protected, promoted, and held as inviolate by both individuals and social political collectives. The protection and promotion of rights, therefore, is a prescription for how things should be and not necessarily a description of how things are. It is a secular attempt to define value and behavior within society outside of any particular religious construct and is a social product of the modern world. Traditionally, religions have constructed values and limits on behaviors via religious justification, generally relying on belief in some transcendent authority to give value and authenticity to claims made via religious discourse. In contrast, the idea of rights originates more from a secular humanist perspective than a religious one, though in the formation of modern Western democracy via the non-denominational deist religious movement that was popular among intellectuals in the founding fathers of the U.S., these secular rights were deemed to be granted by God, the Creator, and subsequently guaranteed by secular government via the Constitution. Since the concept of rights are part of contemporary political and social discourse, for the sake of convenience, we can here list, in addition to the human and civil rights already recognized nationally and globally, the right to genuine self-knowledge as a human being. Not only do you have a right to privacy, self-determination, free speech, free association, freedom of religion and conscience, but also a right to know who and what you truly are. You have a right to know yourself. No one and no thing has any legitimate claim or any legitimate authority to claim or act otherwise. Knowing yourself is the most fundamental of all rights, for how could you ever fully realize the potential of any other rights if you don't know who and what you are? Only through self-knowledge are we able to live up to our fullest and greatest potential and fully exercise any of the other rights we are granted by our social and political institutions. Our sense of self is the very foundation upon which our entire experience of reality and self-expression rests. Nothing could be more fundamental than a right to self-knowledge. Any laws or social, political, religious, cultural structures that interfere with or affect your ability to know yourself are a clear violation of your right to self-knowledge and the liberation and freedom that comes with it. Self-knowledge is the ultimate freedom, and there is none greater or more crucial to genuine freedom. If this freedom and right is not fully protected, then all other rights are relatively meaningless. The right to self-knowledge and self-liberation trumps all other rights, duties, and laws when in conflict. This issue is important to understand because in many cases and in many countries, the greatest tools with the most profound potential for aiding in the discovery of self-knowledge, non-dual experience, and liberation are illegal, and their use can result in being put in prison and thus losing one's other rights. The tools in question are psychedelics, both organic and synthetic. In some limited cases, the consumption of psychedelics has been recognized as a legal right when used in the context of religious and spiritual practice. For example, in the U.S., Native Americans, via the Native American Religious Freedom Restoration Act, are exempted from federal drug laws and may legally consume peyote, which contains the illegal psychedelic compound mescaline. Similarly, here in Ashland, Oregon, where this is being written, the local Santo Daime Church sued the federal government for recognition of their right to drink the ayahuasca tea of Daime, which contains DMT, as central to their religious practice. In both cases, exemptions from federal drug laws were made explicitly because the consumption of Daime and peyote are central to the deeply held religious beliefs of the two religions, and such exemptions are seen to be a requirement when upholding the right to freedom of religion and religious practice and expression. While this is a positive outcome for the members of both religions, it fails to recognize or even concede that a more fundamental right exists for all humans, and that is the freedom to explore our own being and consciousness as we might see fit. The result is that someone who wants to consume psychedelics in a religious setting has a socially recognized route to pursue to have that right protected, but someone who does not want to belong to such a religion does not have this same right. In other words, you can only legally experience psychedelics if you are overtly and specifically religious in your use, but not if you are secular. This is a far too limited recognition of our rights. In fact, for those seeking the full knowledge and liberation, those seeking full self-knowledge and liberation, religious and spiritual traditions are largely obstacles to the kind of work that such a pursuit requires. It is a terrible irony that only those who profess belief in religious dogmas are granted the right to consume psychedelics, while those who might seek to use them as tools for liberation independently from any religious or spiritual superstructure or organization are deemed outlaws and criminals. The ironic result is that the more you can justify your practice through religious belief and doctrine, the more likely you are to have your rights protected, which is a clear favoring of rights for the religious, but not the secular. All right, well, I've already been going on for an hour here. So I think probably next week I'm going to share the chapter that comes in at page 165 of Entheogenic Liberation, which is Being a Non-Dual Energetic Practitioner. This is the chapter that I supplied to Russell before he released his video and his hit piece on Mark Hayden using me as a tool to create the treachery of images. And I'm just going to read the first paragraph here. And this chapter, in many ways, is a replication of the talk that I would give to all my clients when they first came to work with me. Keep in mind that I covered pretty much all the issues that I've already highlighted here by reading you the table of contents of the book. So I covered a lot of material, a lot of ground with my clients before I ever worked with them. And in this chapter, I started off by saying, the chances that anyone reading this is qualified to be considered a full non-dual psychedelic therapy practitioner are slim. In order to be such, you must have gone through all the work detailed in this book and personally reached a point of liberation from your ego. You must both know yourself and have given yourself permission to be yourself at all times and in all situations. That's a high standard. So this section of the book is more an example of imaginative illustration, included here to inform readers of what such a practice looks like and what it entails, but with very little expectation that anyone will be able to directly implement it. However, this book is also written with the hope that a few brave and determined individuals may, in fact, reach the point where they could qualify as a genuine practitioner and not simply a provider. So I'll leave it at that for now. I will also, once again, extend the invitation to anyone out there who did a session or multiple sessions with me who feels that they have an issue or concern to reach out and contact me directly. I made this offer on my last podcast. I made it in the interview with Rob. I made it on the original post of the video that Russell produced. I have yet to personally hear from anyone. And as Russell has and his team and his folks over this at Symposia, I know that you guys have spread some stuff around online, supposedly from people who worked with me with some issues. Those issues have not been brought to me directly. I have not been able to vet or verify that information in any way, so I don't really have any comment on it. That really, it's my policy is going to be, unless somebody comes to me, there's nothing that I'm really going to say about it, because I need to be able to vet the information and actually confirm that I actually worked with these people who have something to say. And as I said last week, I'm just going to repeat it again, that if you have worked with me and if you have a concern, I am fully 100% open and available to hear you out. And if you want me to talk about it publicly, I will. If you don't want me to, I won't. I am open to your feedback. And there's not much else I can say. Just know that I'm here. I'm available. Unlike Russell, I'm willing to talk to anyone. I don't have anything to hide. I'm open. And I'm not some kind of predator. I mean, does it fit the profile if I really were someone who is all interested in power and abusing others? Why would I walk away from it? Why would I willingly say, you know what? I've had enough of this practice. I've learned everything that I need to learn. Now I'm going to shift gears. And I'm going to start sharing this with people and making myself available for consultations to help people integrate the very big experience of 5-MeO-DMT, non-duality, and the nature of being. Because that's what I've been doing. I'm not looking to serve anybody any medicine or practice in that capacity anymore. It was a learning phase for me. And again, the result is my book, Entheogenic Liberation. So if you really want to judge the work, read the book. Russell, read the book. And you know, I've written a lot more than that too. This all dates back to my 2009 book, Being Human. That's where this whole thing started. So you might want to start there if you really want to know. Okay, Russell? And again, if you want to come on the podcast and if you want to have an actual conversation, I'm open to that. So anyway, last week I did say that I was going to put out the interview that I did with Rob, kind of addressing point by point the issues raised by Symposia. Obviously, I didn't do that this week because I had some other things on my mind and I wanted to talk about it. So I've done that. Maybe next week I will be putting out that interview from Rob. I'm not entirely certain yet. I might be putting out the section from Being a Non-Dual Energetic Practitioner from Entheogenic Liberation. I'm going to put all this out on the podcast in some order, but you know, we'll see next week where we're at. And maybe by that point, I will have received a response from someone who says, hey, I had an issue with the session I had with you, and could you address that on your podcast? And so maybe I'll talk about that. You know, I don't know. We'll see when we get there, but that's where I'm at for right now. Thank you for listening. I'll talk to you next week. Gonna enlist the help of my wife to close this out with a little music. All right. Talk to you later, Russell. I'm sure we'll be continuing this in some manner or another. Bye.
Welcome to the Tryptamine Molecular Express. Passengers are encouraged to sit back, relax, and enjoy the ride. Do not attempt to hold on, as there is nothing to hold on to. Feel sensations as they present themselves. Surrender to the energy and keep hands and feet inside the universe at all times. Should discomfort arise, check to see that you are breathing calmly and keep your body in a relaxed, symmetrical position. We will now initiate launch procedure.
Cosmic ride, we're going down the wormhole, take a look inside. The universe unfolds, eternity. Slip down the wormhole, touch infinity. Down the wormhole, down the wormhole, down the wormhole, down the wormhole, down the wormhole. Down the wormhole, down the wormhole, down the wormhole, down the wormhole, down the wormhole.
the center of all existence. Feel free to explore your fractal nature, but be sure not to misplace your mind.
Fractal.
Wherever your ongoing journey takes you. And remember, no matter where you go,